France's first elected president and last emperor, the man who led a Bonapartist restoration only to suffer a similar fate to his predecessor, deposition and exile, a Jacksonian Democrat and Israelian conservative, the forerunner to Bismarckian and even de Gaullist politics, the last defender of a papal Rome, protector of Christians in the Levant, the power behind the Emperor of Mexico, the man who renovated Paris and kick-started France's second colonial empire, the man who left France, a second-rate power on the continent, overshadowed by the might of Imperial Germany, a compulsive adventurer and serial bungler, and one of the most consequential personalities of the 19th century, Napoleon III, the Little Emperor. Karl Marx, in his 18th Brumerie of Louis Bonaparte, later Napoleon III, opens by stating, "Hegel remarks that all great historic facts and personages appear twice. He forgot to add, the first time was tragedy, the second time was farce." Marx's sentiment here is only compounded by his earlier remarks on the uninspiring King of the French, the citizen king Louis-Philippe. Every giant presupposes a dwarf. Every genius, a hide-bound Philistine. We can forgive Marx a little, writing at the beginning of the reign of Louis Napoleon, but he is only half right in respect to the Bonapartist dynastic saga. Napoleon III was no Louis-Philippe, and the reigns of both Napoleons would come to reveal themselves as tragedies. It is only a question of the scale of tragedy. Both Napoleons would come to exhibit the same vices and display moments of brilliance. Both had the opportunity to leave France greater than they found it, only to leave it weaker. But I would never claim that the caricature Napoleon ever rose to inspire a modicum of the fear and adulation as did the original. Victor Hugo derided Napoleon III as Napoleon le Petit, Napoleon the Small, in contrast to Napoleon le Grand, Napoleon the Great. I would contrast the two Napoleons as the Great and the Little, though both were emperors and both were unmistakably Bonapartes. The contrast is best summed up in the assessment of Napoleon III's first foreign minister. The emperor, speaking here of Napoleon III, has immense desires and limited abilities. He wants to do extraordinary things, but is only capable of extravagances, as opposed to the first Napoleon, whose ambitions were matched by his abilities. Anyone who's familiar with this channel should already be well acquainted with Napoleon. Indeed, there are numerous streams on this channel dedicated specifically to the topic of Napoleon, but I'll briefly bring him up because you can't help but compare the two Napoleons for this stream. Of course, Napoleon, Corsican upstart, the son of Carlo Bonaparte come Charles Bonaparte, someone who had to ratify his nobility as a patrician of Tuscany. The young Napoleon Bonaparte becomes a officer of artillery, goes on to join the army of Republican Revolutionary France, turns the Italian campaign into a sideshow, into the principal theatre of warfare against Austria, driving the Austrians out, and he does this twice, leads an expedition to Egypt, comes back, launches a coup, becomes first consul of France and later emperor of the French, declaring that I am the revolution. And the revolution has taken on a deliberately autocratic and indeed you could even say conservative turn in the fact that he appears to be restoring the monarchy under a different dynasty. He then goes on to defeat Austria, precipitating the collapse of the Holy Roman Empire. He defeats Prussia, consolidating most of Europe into a continental system directed at defeating the British through a maritime embargo. He then invades Spain and ends up making his first major tactical blunder, one that is only compounded when he invades Russia in 1812, leading to the decimation and collapse of the Grande Armée, after which he leads a protracted campaign across 1813 to shore up his empire. He's given multiple times to hold on to power and even retain a larger France, but he would accept total victory or total defeat. He is defeated, forced to exile, his dynasty is deposed, He is sent over to Elba, only to return, and for 100 days he is Emperor of the French once more, only to lead what would ultimately see in hindsight as a doomed attack against a vast coalition of all the European powers arrayed against France. And fortunately, perhaps for the fate of Europe, his campaign is defeated before it really gets going at the Battle of Waterloo, where he comes across the Duke of Wellington. It's here that I would like to discuss essentially what the House of Bonaparte is. Upon Napoleon's coronation as emperor, he set about consolidating his quote-unquote dynasty, which hitherto had only been nominally counted among the ranks of the French nobility. As I said, he had to be ratified as a patrician of Tuscany, which wasn't certain when the French annexed the region of Corsica, if I remember correctly, in the year 1765. So he was a minor French noble, let alone to be counted among the ranks of the French nobility. But here he seems to be a second Clovis-type figure, or a Carolingian type, one who was imposing and establishing his dynasty across Europe through fiat, through military force, and with it, he is bringing with it a new system of French Napoleonic government inspired by aspects of the French Revolution, and bringing with it his codification and consolidation of law in the case of Code Napoleon. He's also bringing in centralizing reforms, fundamentally erasing, you can say, parochial feudal structures in order to make these states more efficient and, most importantly of all, deliver into the French armies more and more levies, conscripts, in order to fight his constant wars. But it's not simply a matter of declaring oneself emperor and going around conquering. In order to legitimate this new Bonaparte dynasty, he begins propagating his dynasty. He begins placing his various relatives on other thrones within Europe. So going back to this map to help understand and explain this point, his elder brother Joseph is made the King of Naples, and later he's given the throne of Spain. In his capacity as King of Spain, he does absolutely terribly. His younger brother, Louis, is made King of Holland, and Napoleon dislikes his rule so much that in 1812 he simply decides to annex Holland outright and depose his brother. His younger brother, Jerome, is given a new kingdom carved out of Western Germany and most of Hanover, the Kingdom of Westphalia. But with the collapse of the Napoleonic Empire, by 1813, 1814, most of these Bonapartist upstarts are cast from their thrones throughout of Europe. And there is a last-ditched attempt by Napoleon twice to make his son, by the Habsburg Princess Mary Louise, Napoleon II, Emperor, once in 1814 and again in 1815. So after Napoleon's final definitive exile to St. Helena in 1815, and he dies later in 1821, Napoleon II becomes the titular Bonapartist Emperor, the King of Rome, and to his Austrian captors, the Duke of Reichstadt. Here he lives as a captive Austrian prince and dies in Vienna of tuberculosis at the age of 21. The only member of the House of Bonaparte who survives the fall of Napoleon is, interestingly enough, his wife, who adopted into the House of Bonaparte through marriage, who was made the reigning Duchess of Parma. So there is a revolutionary impetus in being associated with the House of Bonaparte through the character and actions of Napoleon, the monster, who many of the European monarchies at that time held essentially the fate of Europe in the balance and compelled them to accept his various family members as upstart monarchies throughout all of Europe. This is important to note because it's not simply any other European dynasty. You have direct associations with the name of Bonaparte and the memory of the mythological Bonaparte, the Napoleon le Grand. But how does the would-be Napoleon III fit into this grand scheme? Well, he was born Charles Louis Napoleon. And how, therefore, does he rise to become the heir of the Bonapartist cause? Well, in the system of Bonapartist succession, you have to emphasize the fact that primogeniture is a bit of a nonsense when Napoleon had an elder brother. And of course, Carlo Bonaparte was only the representative of Corsica at the court of Versailles, and Joseph wouldn't die until the year 1844, and Louis, the father of Louis-Napoleon, wouldn't die until 1846. Lucien Bonaparte, Louis's older brother, had already been excluded from the succession due to a political break with Napoleon after he decided to assume the rank of emperor. But it's interesting to consider the circumstances surrounding the birth of Louis-Napoleon, or formerly Charles-Louis-Napoleon, because his birth was contrived by the then empress, the wife of Napoleon, Josephine, to produce an heir. She herself was infertile, so she believed that by marrying her daughter by her previous husband, Beauharnais, that she could produce an heir of her family that would be both Napoleon's grand stepson, but also the granddaughter of Josephine. And by marrying Louis, it would also be his nephew. The first son by this arrangement by Josephine dies during infancy. The second son, Louis, was originally set to become the King of Holland. And so the second son, the second surviving son, Charles Louis, was effectively Napoleon's contingency heir for 3 years until the birth of his own son by Mary Louise. So that's an important note to consider, that the birth of Louis-Napoleon, Charles-Louis-Napoleon, was as a result of dynastic politics and meddling by Josephine. It's almost interesting to consider that he is effectively a Tiberius-esque figure, if we're going to look at the Emperor Augustus and Livia, the Empress contriving to have a member of her family on the throne. And even though Josephine would die in 1814, she would ultimately succeed in having one of her direct descendants and not Napoleon's on the throne. After the Battle of Waterloo, Louis Napoleon fled into exile with his mother Hortense to Switzerland, and then he was educated briefly in Bavaria before finally moving to Rome and Italy. His tutor was one Philippe Labas, the grandson of Maximilien Robespierre's friend and landlord, and as a grandson of Maximilian's friend and landlord, Maurice Duplass, he was effectively initiated into the ranks of radical French politics, not just the political philosophies surrounding Napoleon le Grand, but in particular the radical Jacobin politics of the French Terror from 1793 until 1794. So with an education in radical politics, both Louis Napoleon and his elder brother joined the secret Masonic society, the Carbonari, an organization that sought to end the dominance of Austria and the papacy in Italian affairs. So I don't have a map particularly to explain it, but after the fall of Waterloo, Napoleon was made originally King of Italy. He is deposed. Eugène de Beauharnais was Viceroy of Italy. He was deposed. And it was an entirely new structure, or rather the reinvention of an old structure with some amendments, was placed in control of Italy. In Lombardy and Venetia, Austrian rule was direct, whereas in other parts, Austrian rule was indirect, such as in the Grand Duchy of Tuscany, where relatives of the Austrian emperor ruled. In the south, you had an allied king ruled by a member of the Bourbon dynasty, and then you had the Savoyard dynasty ruling over Sardinia, Piedmont, and of course in the center of Italy you had the temporal realm of the papacy, the papal states. And then someone in the chat is mentioning there were rumors that Napoleon III wasn't actually Louis's biological son. Well, that's quite an interesting point to consider, because Hortense and Louis Napoleon did not get on very well, and Hortense was renowned for her various affairs. So this was a rumor started by Victor Hugo when Victor Hugo was exiled in 1852. He became a serious detractor of Napoleon III, and so it basically became an article of faith that Charles-Louis Napoleon wasn't in fact the son of Louis Bonaparte. He was in fact a bastard by one of Hortense's many lovers. But until that point is proven, it really is rather moot in terms of the grand historical scheme of things. So he becomes a member of a Masonic secret society, inspired and inculcated in the ideas of radical French politics. Now, because the time immediately after the French Revolution, there was an attempt to reorder the system of alliances in Europe to keep various monarchs in power. In 1830, the Bourbon Restoration in France, King Charles X was deposed and replaced by a cousin adopting the title of Citizen King, a title which had been only provisionally adopted by King Louis XVI in 1891 to 1892, and this is called the July Revolution, after which the monarchy in France was known as the July Monarchy. The revolution in France spreads to Belgium, and it spreads to Poland. And the general feeling that the European balance of power is about to collapse and revolutionary forces are about to take over triggers a response by the Austrians in Italy against the Carbonari and any attempts to form some form of free Italy against the wishes of the Pope and the Emperor of Austria. Because the Bonapartes were implicated as part of the Carbonari group, they were forced to flee towards Switzerland, and in the ensuing rout, Louis Bonaparte's older brother died of disease. With the death of Napoleon II, the Duke of Reichstadt the next year, Louis Napoleon became the heir presumptive of the Bonapartist cause. While in Swiss exile, Louis Napoleon consciously emulated the example of his uncle, joining the Swiss army, even going as far as to imagine that he would have his own 100 days restoration, deposing King Louis-Philippe off the back of massive popular support. In the event, his planned march on Paris was a complete farce. After leaving Switzerland and entering Strasbourg on the French border, a Louis Napoleon in the uniform of an artillery officer, again to associate himself with the mythology of his uncle. It should also be noted that I have an image here of the two coup attempts, but in the middle I have the quatre Napoleon, the four Napoleons, and you can see the rather prominent Louis Napoleon with his son, the Prince Imperial, and in the background you have the ethereal, now dead Duke of Reichstadt, Napoleon II, and of course Napoleon I. But I find it interesting that Napoleon I is simply more a background character. He is a pale reflection compared to Napoleon III, which I think in the grand scheme of things makes this idea meant to legitimate Napoleon III seem even more preposterous than it really is. But there you go. So back to the eventual coup, it was a complete farce. After leaving Switzerland and entering Strasbourg on the French border, a Louis Napoleon in the uniform of an artillery officer induces a French army regiment to mutiny, only to be surrounded by troops loyal to King Louis-Philippe, forcing the would-be emperor back into Swiss and ultimately English exile. In 1840, Louis Napoleon invaded France with a single ship and a contingent of 60 men. And consider perhaps the irony that this was supposed to be reminiscent of Napoleon's flight from exile in Elba, albeit in that case he was trying to evade British ships circling across Elba, and ultimately his quarrel was with the English. Well, here he is leaving England on a single ship, and unlike the very dramatic, almost melodramatic example that we have with the first Napoleon, where he encounters troops under the command of Marshal Ney, he declares, "If any one of you wants to shoot your emperor, here I am." They all throw down their weapons. They begin crying and shouting, "Vive l'Empereur, vive l'Empereur." In the case of Napoleon III, upon landing in France, he was immediately arrested and taken off into prison. And it was commented and much ridiculed throughout the press of Europe this time as this extreme novelty. Napoleon III was ultimately derided as an eccentric buffoon. Though while Louis Napoleon's first two coup attempts ended in an embarrassing failure, Louis-Philippe had taken the perhaps misguided measure of overseeing the return of Napoleon's remains from St. Helena, where they were then interned in the grand French military hospital in Paris, Les Invalides. The Napoleonic myth had become a potent political tool. The horrors of Napoleon's wars had been superseded by the memory of past glories. It was under Louis-Philippe also that the Arc de Triomphe was finally completed. In 1840, Louis-Philippe's prime minister, Adolphe Thiers, had suggested that the French reacquire the left bank of the Rhine, as its natural border had been during the Napoleonic Empire. Louis-Philippe was clearly attempting to obfuscate for an increasing level of dissatisfaction with his rule by monopolizing France's Napoleonic legacy to lend his regime a superficial sense of grandeur, while Napoleon's heir was plotting to reclaim the Napoleonic mantle for himself and use it to usurp the so-called citizen king. That's not to say that Louis Napoleon relied exclusively on the legend of his uncle, believing his name sufficient to justify his conquest of power. Louis Napoleon had spent much of the 1830s concocting a political formula for his return to power, his own brand of Bonapartism. And I think it's important here to emphasize that here Bonapartism does become almost a postmodern, post-fact political agenda, as opposed to something simply encapsulated in the personage of one man. Rather, we're talking here about a series of principles that can be replicated, not just among members of the Bonaparte family, but perhaps even into broader political movements, not simply associated with the Bonaparte dynasty. Napoleon's English exile had a profound effect on him. There he had met Charles Dickens and Benjamin Disraeli, future Conservative Party leader and British Prime Minister. While Louis Napoleon was imprisoned in France and continued writing, at the same time that Disraeli was writing Sybil and the Two Nations, the thesis novel for One Nation Conservatism, and Frederick Engels, Karl Marx's famous collaborator, was writing On the Condition of the Working Class in England, Louis Napoleon had published The Extinction of Pauperism, which, as with Disraeli, aimed to capture the working class as a constituent for the right, I use the right very much in quotes, by promising worker security and the amelioration of their general condition. The later Napoleon III can thus be considered Disraeli's continental counterpart before Otto von Bismarck and Prussian socialism as one of the founders of quote-unquote modern conservatism, an absurd term that could only exist within this very particular historical context. But to understand Bonapartism as interpreted by Louis Napoleon himself, I have here a segment from On the Policy and Ideas of Napoleon, a book written by him in his Swiss exile in 1839. Are all the revolutions by which the nations have been agitated, all the efforts of great men, be they warriors or legislators, to end in nothing? Are we incessantly moving in a vicious circle where light succeeds ignorance and barbarism to civilization? Away with so afflicting an idea, the sacred fire which animates us cannot but lead us to results worthy of the divine power which inspires us. In spite of every obstacle, the amelioration of society moves onwards and knows no limits but those of the universe. The human race, in the words of Pascal, is a man who dies not, and is always advancing towards perfection. The image is sublime, for there is truth in it, and depth of thought. The human race dies not, nevertheless is liable to the ailments of humanity, advances constantly towards perfection, but is not exempt from human passions, a perilous though indispensable arsenal to which we owe our elevation from ruin. So talking about this, it fundamentally comes off as post-Rousseauian, the idea that man is free, but everywhere he's in chains. And taken into the context of the 1830s and the 1840s that he is writing, the idea of the perfectibility of man, of the inherent progressivism in history, is something which is taken on by Herder, by Hegel, and of course it is taken on by the materialist teleology of the Marxists, and before the Marxists, of course, the Saint-Simonists, other proto-socialists. So in terms of talking about the improvement of the human race and talking about the idea of moving every obstacle onwards and we know no limit but the universe, again, it's talking in this post-Christian fashion and talking, it's basically a philosophy which is very much focused on humanity. And again, what does he talk about? He talks about the divine power that which inspires us. Again, it seems very much like this more indiscernible sense of providence as opposed to a Christian God. This comparison furnishes an epitome of the principles on which the vitality of nations is based, a vitality which two natures and two instincts, the one divine, tending towards perfection, the other moral, mortal tending towards corruption. And you can say here that he's moving slightly back again from this explicitly socialist mentality. And here he is imbuing it with an aspect of Christian thought, the idea that one finds moral perfection in the pursuit of the divine, and one finds degradation, negation, in terms of becoming completely immersed and beholden to, a slave to, worldly pleasures. Society, therefore, contains two hostile elements, the one of immortality and improvement, the other fraught with disease and disorganization. The several generations, as they follow one another, participate in these same elements. All nations have one sentiment in common, the desire of improvement. Each has a distinguishing characteristic in the peculiar difficulty which paralyzes its efforts. And here, Napoleon is talking about nations effectively as organisms. He has taken on the mantle of political nationalism, which was very much the forefront of France. But in terms of seeing the nation not simply as a legal body or an aspect of ideas, it's interesting to consider here that he's almost taking on a Fichte esque conception of the nation as an organism, the nation as representing blood and soil, as representing a race, a body. I may be reading too much into this, but all of these ideas were floating around at this time. So it's therefore interesting to consider that Napoleon, being a man who wrote various political tracts throughout his entire life, even just before his death, would have been aware of these certain ideas. Indeed, they seem to be responding to the same political programs. Napoleon seems to be responding to the same political ideas that very much influenced Benjamin Disraeli and Thomas Carlyle. Governments are established to assist society in its efforts to overcome the obstacles that impede its progress. Their form varies according to the nature of the evil to which they are called on to apply a remedy, according to the epoch and the nation they are called on to direct. Their task never has been and never will be easy, because the two hostile elements of which our existence is composed demand the application of a different means. The divine essence demands only liberty and occupation for its development. The mortal principle of our nature demands and guides our support. So again, liberty as representing some form of natural right. But again, governments are established to assist society in its efforts to overcome the obstacles that impede progress. So he's assigning government an explicitly moral character, not simply a Machiavellian character. And indeed, Napoleon III here sounds significantly more like a humanitarian sort of utopian socialist, in terms of definitely not a sort of Proudhon anarchist type, but a man who believes that the government, the state, exists essentially to help the condition of the working classes, albeit through his lens of paternalism, through the Bonaparte aristocracy supporting the condition of the working class. So here he seems more ideologically driven than Napoleon, who I would say was not concerned about this. He was far more concerned about a pervading sense of order, especially after the anarchy of the end, complete sort of political paralysis of the Directory and the terror of the French Revolution under Maximilien Robespierre. A government, therefore, is not what a distinguished writer has called it, a necessary ulcer, but rather the beneficent power that imparts motion to all social organization. And as I'm going to explain later, the idea that government is a positive actor and that the government should directly intervene in the condition of the working classes, but in society in general, is something which underpins all of Napoleon's philosophy of government, rather than the idea that the government that governs least is the one that governs best. When we unfold the tablets of history, two great phenomena are constantly before our eyes. On the one hand, an unvarying system, obedient to a regular impulse of progression and always maintaining the advance it has once effected. On the other hand, we behold flexibility and change. The one is the principle of progress, the other the mere form of government. The principle of progress never disappears, though often displaced. It passes from among those who govern to those who are governed. But the tendency of revolutions is to transfer it to the ruling power. When this principle actuates the government, its advance is bold, for it leads. When it actuates the masses, its advance is slow and unsteady, for then it struggles. In the former hypothesis, a confident people allows itself to be governed. In the latter, the people is desirous of being its own agent. So here again, he's talking about the fundamental basis of progressive government, one that elevates, is a government, a ruling class, which rules in concert with those below. For if you defy that, you are going to create a condition where power will be usurped from below, i.e. the general conditions which create a revolution. And bear in mind that by this point, France has had multiple changes of government since 1789, when we have the French Revolution. Since the existence of the world, this progress has been incessant. To recognize it, we need only trace the march of civilization, marked as it is by the great names that measure the intervals. They rise in eminence as we approach the goal. From Alexander, we proceed to Caesar. From Caesar to Constantine. From Constantine to Charlemagne. From Charlemagne to Napoleon. And again, he begins the opinions and ideas of Napoleon by giving a brief memoir in which he very much emphasizes his legitimacy as the heir of Napoleon. So in terms of relaying history as the progressive march of certain great men and leading it to Napoleon, then it's very clear that his legitimacy stems from being part of this progressive inheritance of ultimately the great man. And this in many ways actually takes a bit of a turn from Rousseau, because Rousseau of course believes that the state of nature, the hallowed state of nature, represents some sort of halcyon bliss. If anything, it's a perversion. I think it's very much taken from the idea of the Garden of Eden, the idea of the primordial paradise. But in the case of Rousseau, he attaches it to classicism, the veneration of pre-Christian civilization, ancient Greece and ancient Rome, as some form of model to be emulated. In that case, Rousseau was simply following a trend that was set by the culture at that time. But here, Napoleon seems to be taking on a different role, which is very much Hegelian, that mankind is moving towards something. There is an animating spirit or providence that is guiding us there, and he can be the agent of that. The forms of government, on the contrary, do not obey unvarying laws. Elective and hereditary power have for centuries been struggling for preeminence and have prevailed alternatively, as science and knowledge, justice and strength have been arrayed on either side. Governments, therefore, cannot be based on never varying forms. A form of government that shall promote the happiness of every nation is an idea as visionary as that of a panacea for the cure of all maladies. Every question of political forms, as had been said by Carroll, is to be solved by the condition of society and by that alone. In these words, a truth of mighty import is comprised. In politics, all is relative, nothing is absolute. So here he is advocating for a flexible program of political action which responds to the conditions that one finds on the ground. There is no ideal form of government. And this, if anything, acts as some sort of template for how we see the transitions of Napoleon's own government, which starts off as effectively a directorship, an autocracy to begin with, and after 1859 it becomes more progressively parliamentarian. We have the right to strike, we have the lifting of press censorship, and by 1870 it looks as if France is simply going to become a parliamentary monarchy such as Britain, even with the idea effectively being floated around but never quite fulfilled, that you would have a government drawn from Parliament, and Napoleon and his son, the Prince Imperial, would effectively serve as a titular figurehead. So again, we have the idea that he does not believe that despotism or total power is necessary. And you can also see this in Napoleon himself, Napoleon, the original Napoleon, the fact that he essentially assumed the power of an emperor off the back of, you can say, a lot of movements. You know, you can say a large amount of it was the desire to personally aggrandize oneself, but really it was about the consolidation of power, the legitimation of that power, and receiving a blessing from the Catholic Church, being able to bring aspects of the population who had been hostile to the revolution on board by giving this Jacobin autocrat, a veneer of sanctity, which was the case with Napoleon I. He was very much a cynical man who adopted these programs with a degree of flexibility. And indeed, going to Thomas Carlyle, unlike what Napoleon is trying to illustrate here, Napoleon simply was orchestrating his political beliefs based on the idea of necessity and, by extension, the necessity of him as some sort of modern Caesar. And so thereby any sort of principle he assumed, every sort of political program he made was made around this principle. There was an inherent flexibility to Bonapartism, which means it doesn't necessarily have to be called a monarchy or an empire. That's just the form which it took. And of course, it's politically expedient for the future Napoleon to directly try and imitate that model which has already been set to him by his mythological predecessor. And I mean mythological not in the sense that Napoleon I wasn't real, I mean in the sense that the Napoleonic myth really was based on a profound nostalgia for glory rather than the reality of the conscriptions, the economic destitution, and the total defeat of France that followed 1814 and 1815. If we omit the above ideas, it is impossible we should attach much importance to the learned distinction set up by political writers between the government of one and the government of many, between democratic and aristocratic governments. All have been good in their kind, since all have a duration, but for many nations that form has been the best, of which the duration has been the longest. But a priori, the best government is that which best fulfills its mission, that is to say, which fashions itself according to the exigencies of its epoch, and which, modelling itself according to the existing state of society, prepares an easy road for advancing civilization. I regret to say that at the present day, I see only two governments that fulfill their providential mission. I mean the two colossi at the extremities, the one of the old world and the other of the new. While our old European centre is like a volcano consuming itself in its crater, the Eastern and the Western nation are unhesitatingly advancing towards improvement, the one obedient to the will of an individual, the other guided by freedom. Providence has confided to the United States of America the care of peopling and civilizing the immense territory which stretches from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from the pole to the equator. The government, a simple administration, has hitherto merely to practice the old adage, laissez-faire, laissez-passer, to favor the irresistible instinct which impels the population of America towards the West. In Russia, it is to the imperial dynasty we are indebted for the whole of that movement which for a century and a half has been rescuing that vast empire from barbarism. The imperial power has to struggle against all those time-honored prejudices of our antique Europe. It must centralize as much as possible in the hands of an individual the whole energy of the state in order to destroy the abuses which perpetuate themselves under cover of communal and feudal privileges. It is from Russia alone that the East can receive the ameliorations that wait us. Now consider a political writer who would look at the United States of America and Tsarist Russia and compare them and say they are equally beneficial, but he doesn't do so out of any sense of ideological prejudice. He doesn't here consider himself a democrat or an absolutist. He is simply, in his view, stating that the conditions in one favor a certain type of government and the conditions in the other favor the extreme opposite. And here he's talking about extremes. Just notice here, however, how this can almost be seen as some form of presage for his own style of government, how it's going to waver between these extremes, a plebiscitary autocrat, and then a man who tries to usher in France a genuine form of parliamentary government with a increasing level of opposition against his rule, which he tolerates, and he grants amnesty towards his former political opponents. You can say these extremes, the contrast between Tsarist Russia and the tendency to centralize, and again, the impetus he says is to rescue Russia from barbarism, and the civilizing mission he ascribes to the United States, both governments are appropriate for the places they occupy and for the peoples over which they govern. But thou, France, the land of Henry IV, of Louis XIV, of Cano, of Napoleon, thou who wert ever for Western Europe the source of progression, thou to whom is given to unite the two great supports of empire, the genius of peaceful arts and the genius of war, hast thus no longer a mission to fulfill. Are they force and energy to be wasted in incessant struggles with thy own children? No, such cannot be thy destiny. The day will soon arrive when then, to govern thee, it will be necessary to feel that thy part is to throw into every treaty the sword of Brennus in behalf of civilization. And yes, he is emphasizing aspects of de Tocqueville. And again, it should be noted, Gustav, that de Tocqueville, of course, was actually a member of his government early on as a member of the Party of Order. But here he's basically saying that France has lost its right for any sort of international admiration, as its political system is simply going through the cycles of perpetual revolution. We have Louis XVI, we have Robespierre, we have the Directory, we have Napoleon as consul, Napoleon as emperor, we have the Restoration, we have Napoleon again, we have the Restoration again. And since 1830, so this is 9 years after the July Revolution, we have Louis-Philippe. France is going through a cycle of ineffective political regimes, and he is trying to strike a formula in which France can have the best of both worlds, and its political system can be not only stable within France, but it could be a source of potential emulation. And here he will ultimately stick on the idea of empire. And as we see with Mexico, he is so confident in the idea of the French Empire that he believes a system of government that should indeed be exported. Now, I could read on a little bit, but I think for the sake of this conversation, that's enough in terms of just bringing us in to the sense of Napoleon III's political ideology. Now, back to his rapid rise from power, which seems completely farcical given the Swiss attempt at going to Strasbourg, marching on Paris, and then his invasion of France, only to end up in prison, the complete opposite of what we see with the Hundred Days. What enables his rise to power, as with the original Napoleon, is a revolution. In 1848, François Guizot, the longtime prime minister and conservative stalwart behind Louis-Philippe's government, bans banquets. Now, banquets have essentially been forums, salons, to express antipathy towards the government. And when François Guizot bans banquets, it's basically seen as a last-ditched attempt to silence criticism of the government. And this precipitates a very, very quick revolution. The beginning of the 1848 revolutions throughout all of Europe except Great Britain and Russia. And this also, France is the origin of this, as it was the origin of the July Revolution in 1830. But this is the nail in the coffin for the Orléanist regime, which never had that much support behind it. It was a temporary regime which was seen to moderate the seemingly excesses of Charles X and the Legitimists. Louis-Philippe goes into exile, and a republic is declared. In the elections that shortly followed to the newly consecrated National Assembly of the Republic, Louis Napoleon's uncle Jerome, the former king of Westphalia, and two of Napoleon's cousins were elected to the new National Assembly. In contrast to his kinsmen, Louis Napoleon was viewed as a dangerous subversive by the army and the temporary executive for France, General Cavaignac, less due to his name than his seemingly radical socialist inclinations, which were put on display with the extinction of pauperism. The turning point for Louis Napoleon came with the leftist June uprising in response to the seeming political dominance of the conservatives in this new republic. Cavaignac brutally represses this uprising, with as many as 5,000 insurgents killed. It should be noticed that Napoleon Le Grand, of course, in 1795, in the 13th of Vendémiaire, has his own equivalent of putting down insurgents, except in this case, they're not leftist Republicans, they're royalists. But in that case, where the famous phrase, I believe it was immortalized from Carlyle, I might be wrong, the whiff of the grape shot, only 300 insurgents were put down by Napoleon, as opposed to the 5,000 of Cavaignac. So we're talking about a general atmosphere of extreme political violence in the capital. Louis Napoleon, however, had disassociated himself from the uprising, placating those that considered him too radical and too aligned with the radical leftist socialists, while he was not associated with the brutality of Cavaignac's crackdown. A new constitution was created for the Republic, which created an executive presidency elected via universal male suffrage, France's first. And this is what I mean by Jacksonian Democrats, something I brought up in the introduction. The idea that it's supposed to be the common sense of the average man and the entire American populace is assembled, which can act as some form of counterweight against the middle. And this is very much embodied in Disraeli and the idea of counteracting the support of the liberals by appealing to the two nations of above and from below. So Louis Napoleon wins this first election decisively, and he does so by appealing both to social conservatives through the Catholic Church. And again, I'm not sort of necessarily sure how sincere Napoleon III's adherence to the Catholic Church is, given his acceptance of providence, his acceptance of divine power, but the fact that he is very much heterodox in his viewpoints. But he is very consistent throughout most of his policies in terms of his adherence to protecting Catholics or believing that the Catholic Church should form a fundamental pillar of French society. So that's an important point to consider, the fact that his basis, his legitimacy and power rests on the support of a large agrarian, social, poor agrarian base, some working class in the cities, but those ever diminish with the rise of Marxism. But compared to this social conservative Catholic element, we have leftists who are drawn to him by his program of social reform. All the while, this is bolstered, his popularity is bolstered by his illustrious lineage and his conscious association with, conscientious association with the original Napoleon, Napoleon Le Grand. And so in contravention, when he's elected to the trappings of a republic, this radical leftist adopts the title not of president, but of prince president. And something which immediately shocks everyone, he countermands an expeditionary force which had been sent to Italy to send to assist the young Italian revolutionary movement led by the radical Mazzini, who was promulgating, among other things, European sort of democratic unity and a unification of Italy against the Austrians and against the Pope. The king of Piedmont, Sardinia, alongside these Italian revolutionaries, was fighting a war against the Austrians, while Pope Pius IX had fled Rome, where a Roman Republic had been proclaimed. Louis Napoleon sent this expeditionary force, which the Republic had sent to assist the rebels, he instead sent it to restore Pope Pius IX. This instantly garnered the support among France's Catholics, while alienating many convinced secular, non-religious Republicans. And I don't believe this was a token gesture, as I've insinuated with his defense of Catholicism. Napoleon would remain as the Pope's protector until his fall, while the Catholic Church would be revered as a pillar of French society, compounded with the Loi Fallu that confirmed the laws of Fallu, that confirmed the Church's role in the French education system. And also compare this with Napoleon. Of course, Napoleon is famous for his Concordat, where he makes the Catholic Church the privileged religion of France, restoring many of their rights, but he maintains various Gallican principle that the emperor is in control of the appointment of bishops, and there are protections stipulated for Jews and Protestants, but the Catholic Church is effectively the privileged, if not the exclusive, state religion of France. This is something very much Louis Napoleon defends. However, it should also be noted that Napoleon did not, the original Napoleon, did not have a good relationship with the popes, and he was responsible for getting rid of several, deposing them from Rome twice. So it should be interesting here that when the second Napoleon comes in and has restored power, one of his first acts is to restore the Pope to Rome and not depose him. Louis Napoleon meant to rule as an executive president, which France had never really had an executive president before. The only real example to point to is the first consul, Napoleon Bonaparte. Following his protection of Pope Pius IX, French monarchists won a decisive majority in France's assembly elections. Disaffected socialists then led a second June uprising in 1849, which effectively ended any genuine support for the new republic. Adolphe Thiers and Alexis de Tocqueville were at the head of this so-called Party of Order, representing a vast coalition of all monarchist parties, supporters of Louis-Philippe, the Orleanist candidate, and of the Comte de Chambord, the grandson of Charles X and the inheritor of the mantle of the Bourbons. But as a result of this new coalition that had come in on the wave of Catholic support, Adolphe Thiers began considering the restriction of the vote and attacked the Prince President's policy of social reform. Essentially, he believed it was subversive and would undermine French society at that time, but namely the control of various sect of conservative thinkers such as de Tocqueville and Thiers. So when Louis Napoleon's term was due to expire, he was constitutionally bound to step down and not seek re-election. Then, from the point of view of the Party of Order, it may be assumed that either the legitimist Henry the Comte de Chambord would restore the monarchy, or if the Orleanists got their way, a regency would be established for the young Philippe, the Count of Paris, the grandson of Louis-Philippe. The fact that the French monarchists were split among three factions, legitimist, Orleanist, and Bonapartist, only worked in favour of Louis Napoleon, as he was already the incumbent head of state. Having failed to change the constitution to permit his re-election, Louis Napoleon, with the support of the army, committed a coup against the Republic, easily defeating any makeshift resistance assembled by the writer and politician Victor Hugo. After a gerrymandered plebiscite akin to that of his uncle, Louis Napoleon was given sweeping powers to amend the constitution as he saw fit. Strict censorship of the press and mass arrests followed. Victor Hugo was banned from entering France and remained in exile for 20 years, while Louis Napoleon dispossessed the House of Orléans of all their property, effectively believing that his opposition came from the extreme left, from individual journalists and writers who had originally supported him, such as Victor Hugo, but of course from any monarchist contenders, such as the House of Orléans. With the powers of an autocratic dictator, the change in title from Prince President to Emperor became a mere formality. And as Napoleon Bonaparte switched from consul, so Louis Napoleon Bonaparte switched from Prince President to Emperor of the French. In both instances, they were elected at the behest of the French Senate. The constitution was given a Napoleonic veneer, recapturing the names of the old institutions, as well fundamentally as their impotence. Because Napoleon, as Napoleon III, ruled as effective absolute monarchs with only some form of constitutional constitutional deference to this idea of a American-style separation of powers. From 1852 to 1859, Napoleon ruled with absolute power, with a gag on the press and a centralized police system. This system would remain until the period of so-called liberal or parliamentary empire following 1859, in which the emperor would face ever-increasing opposition and press criticism, the Union des Boyaux, which had all movements from leftists to monarchists. Ultimately, he had opposition from all quarters, socialists and even legitimists. As an autocrat, though, he was now free to implement his domestic reform agenda. The government directed the building of infrastructure. In Paris, he established the Gare de Lyon and the Gare du Nord and increased the mileage of French railways by a factor of 6 in his 18-year reign. This was funded by the creation of new financial institutions such as Crédit Immobilier. The improvement in infrastructure was compounded by France's pioneering role in the development of steamships and the construction of a vast merchant navy. In addition, France constructed the first naval steamship, the Napoleon, in 1850. These measures were overshadowed by the Napoleonic magnum opus of public works, the renovation of Paris, overseen by Napoleon's prefect, Georges-Eugène Haussmann. Paris was enlarged to its current boundaries, new reservoirs provided greater access to clean water, the Parisian sewers were rebuilt. Derelict housing was demolished, and a new system of boulevards were built with street lighting. Inspired by London's Hyde Park, recreation sites such as the Bois de Boulogne broke the mass of the urban landscape. Giacomo Meyerbeer had established Paris as the centre of European opera during the Second Empire. Now Paris had a new opera house, though the construction of the Palais Garnier would not be completed until 1875. The Palais Garnier and the design of the boulevards became an iconic staple of the Second Empire style, alongside the music of Hector Berlioz, and you could even say the budding revolution in fine arts with Manet and what would later become Impressionism. Napoleon Legrand had opined on making Paris the most beautiful city that ever was. Although Napoleon Le Petit would not live to see the completion of the renovations, Paris, throughout his reign, being one colossal construction site, and then ultimately marred by the uprising of the Paris Commune, it could be argued he succeeded in this endeavor. It should also be noted that his idea for renovation wasn't restricted to public works and vast building projects such as the renovations of Paris. We have also to look at his restorations of various historical buildings, employing the great restorer Eugène Viollet-le-Duc, who was responsible for the restoration of the medieval city of Carcassonne. We have the restoration of Mont Saint-Michel and being open to allowing it to become open to the public, to tourism. We have the restoration of Saint-Chapelle, perhaps of particular note given what has now happened to Notre-Dame de Paris. He was responsible for the renovation of that cathedral, Notre-Dame de Paris. So Napoleon, if anything, rather than being an agent of the French Revolution, is consciously a romantic monarch. He is trying to restore not only the aspects of his uncle's reign, but he's also trying to restore or recapture elements of pre-revolutionary society by his veneration and restoration of these sacred sites for French Catholics, but also reminiscent of France's medieval past. And you can say in this case, he's similar to a figure like Ludwig II of Bavaria or King Frederick Wilhelm IV of Prussia, who was responsible for the construction of Hohenzollern Castle and the completion of Cologne Cathedral. Nevertheless, Napoleon III was not entirely successful in mobilizing the working classes to support the Second Empire. His reforms to the monetary, education, economic system of France were far more interventionist than that of England, his model, presaging the dirigisme of de Gaulle in the 1960s, the idea of state-sponsored interventionism, while embracing aspects of free trade that opened the French market up to international consumer goods and made goods cheaper for French consumers to purchase. For workers, we also have the right to strike from, I believe, the year 1864 onwards. The state as a paternalistic actor here, according to Napoleon, would serve to ameliorate the condition of the working classes and provide them with the opportunities for advancement, they being the working classes, by maintaining the traditional class structure of France, albeit he had to carefully maneuver throughout the myriad clubs and anti-Bonapartist royalist societies that wanted him deposed. In a similar way, the Catholic support for Napoleon came under strain after the Italian unification and the rise of a pro-papal ultra-monotone faction, which believed in strict adherence to the Pope in all matters spiritual. Karl Marx, author of the Communist Manifesto, published in the same year as Louis Napoleon's election as Prince President, preached the inevitability of class struggle and that the economic condition of the working class, or proletariat, the urban working class, was inextricably linked to their political empowerment, the dictatorship of the proletariat. Towards the end of the empire, supporters of Marx, among other radical republicans, grouped together as the irreconcilables, opposed to the very principle of Bonapartism, and fomented strikes in the year 1869, just before the end of the reign. At the beginning of 1870, the dynasty was rocked to its core by scandal. A journalist, Victor Noir, was killed by Pierre Bonaparte, the emperor's cousin, inciting an uprising by the irreconcilables. The government put down the uprising, but to placate the unrest, the emperor conceded the principle of government by parliament, rather than an executive monarchy. This principle was confirmed by a popular plebiscite with the agrarian population supporting the emperor. Those who voted to disfavor this proposal were effectively voting for the abolition of the monarchy, and they came namely from the cities. It should be noted that domestic opposition to the emperor coincides with France's diplomatic isolation and the decline of the emperor's health and even enthusiasm for the imperial project. While the Franco-Prussian War was the immediate cause for the fall of France's last monarch, it is arguable how well the Bonapartist cause would have fared, even in a favourable diplomatic environment. For charting the Emperor's foreign policy, I have divided the segment into the Napoleonic adventures, colonial and broader global policy, and his disastrous European foreign policy. Napoleon the Grand's success was in Europe. From Egypt to the attempted reconquest of Haiti, Napoleon consistently failed to make an impression globally, and instead attempted to defeat the maritime power of Britain by denying her the economic markets of the continent through the continental system. The Louisiana Purchase was nothing if not indicative of France's precarious global situation, though this was the fault of Louis XV and the loss of France's first colonial empire, Quebec, Canada, and significant possessions in India. Napoleon III was not responsible for the Second Colonial Empire. Charles X, in his brief reign, had asserted French power abroad and commenced the conquest of Algeria, and by extension, the elimination of the Barbary slave trade. Napoleon inherited this mantle and took it much further, attempting to transform France into a world power to rival Britain, though allying with Britain when it suited France's interests. Lord Palmerston, the British Foreign Minister and Prime Minister, was always wary of Napoleon's ambitions, though this should not detract from the fact that Napoleon displays here a spark of genius, constructing a French empire in the shadow of Britain rather than openly challenging Britain. Essential to Napoleon's vision was the modernization of the French Navy, as I've already alluded to, with its aspects of creating the world's second largest maritime navy, but also the world's second largest seafaring navy, second to Britain, while France's expeditionary and irregular colonial armies were expanded, including that of the French Foreign Legion. The French Foreign Legion wasn't created by Napoleon III, but he was responsible for massively expanding its scope. In 1852, France completed the conquest of Algeria and began consolidating its rule over Senegal, turning Dakar into the nucleus of French expansion into what would later become French West Africa, the largest European empire in Africa, albeit taking much of the Sahara, while Britain took over the best bits effectively. It should also be noted that Napoleon III had an interesting policy to Algeria, one that was bitterly resented by the French colonists there. He effectively restricted French colonization to the northern coast while attempting to placate the various Bedouin tribes in the interior of Algeria. And as a result of this, in all of the plebiscites, it should be noted that the Algerian French population absolutely hated Napoleon III. And I'm drawing a conscious example here, a conscious association here between Napoleon III and de Gaulle, because of course de Gaulle also supposedly turned against the French population in Algeria to the point that there was a concerted attempt to assassinate him. But it's interesting to see all of these interesting parallels throughout history in terms of earning the ire of the French colonial population in Algeria. It's also interesting to consider that Napoleon III's political protege, Maximilian, the emperor of Mexico, took it upon himself to guarantee various rights for indigenous groups in the Yucatan Peninsula, the descendants of the Mayans. And this, of course, earned the enmity of the established elite in Veracruz and in Mexico City. So in some ways, Napoleon and Maximilian of Mexico were similar. With the Opium War, Asia was opened as a principal theater of great power competition, the Opium War, Britain, of course, defeating Qing Dynasty China. Britain was already ascendant in India. In a few years, they would consolidate and become the Empire of India, with Queen Victoria as the Empress. Britain was also ascendant in Malaysia, thereby controlling access effectively to the East China Sea, in particular, controlling Singapore. And they had also by now established a major port in Hong Kong that would become the impetus for further interests, spheres of influence being carved out into China and even beyond. The Dutch and even the Portuguese presence in the Far East eclipsed that of France, which was relegated to Pondicherry in India and a few islands in Polynesia, such as Tahiti, and New Caledonia. Just for reference, the Portuguese at this time controlled Macau, but they also controlled East Timor, while the Dutch controlled what is now modern Indonesia. In the Second Opium War, France fought alongside Britain and won concessions as part of a system of unequal treaties, which forced China open to Western economic and missionary access. Effectively, French settlers were allowed to establish themselves in various towns, notably Shanghai and Tientsin, and they were also given extraterritorial rights. But again, this wasn't so much on the initiative of Napoleon, but rather he is following the lead which has already been set by his erstwhile British adversary, Lord Palmerston. To further cement French influence in the East and begin to take the initiative rather than simply following on from Britain, Napoleon used the Vietnamese persecution of Catholic missionaries as a pretext for demanding concessions in what would ultimately used to be called Saigon, but is now called Ho Chi Minh City in Cochin China. With a French presence in Vietnam now established, France established a client king in Cambodia, with the forced acquiescence of the King of Siam. And you can see this rather obsequious diplomatic mission being led by the Thais to the Emperor and the Empress Eugenie at the Palace of Fontainebleau. This was the beginning of what would ultimately be the complete conquest of Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos by France that would be completed 15 years after the deposition of Napoleon III in 1885. Other ventures in the Far East were less successful, including an attempt to access the Hermit Kingdom of Korea and gain a foothold in Japan by supporting the shogun, the Tokugawa shogun, in 1867, only for the shogun to be deposed in the Meiji Restoration the following year. Perhaps trumping all of these gains for France was the construction of the Suez Canal by Ferdinand de Lesseps between 1859 and 69. Arguably, Napoleon III's Egyptian policy was far more significant, if less dramatic, than Napoleon the Great and his square formations firing at the Mamluks under the shadow of the pyramids. This, of all the French policies of the Second Empire, was the greatest existential threat to the British Empire, one they would have to offset by purchasing the canal in the following decade and ultimately invading Egypt. Unfortunately for France, they had invested in it. They had been responsible for building it. But of course, it was technically owned by, or rather within, the sovereign territory of the Khedive of Egypt. During the tenureship of Disraeli, a few years after the completion of the Suez Canal, Disraeli contracts a loan by Rothschild to buy the Suez Canal. And under the second administration of, the second premiership of Gladstone, of William Gladstone, the British invade Egypt to prevent a anti-Western uprising taking over control in Alexandria and Cairo. So, albeit the French are responsible for building the Suez Canal, the British ultimately seize the initiative afterwards and are able to run rings around Jules Ferry, the colonial minister of the French Third Republic, and effectively win the great game by guaranteeing these various possessions for Britain, albeit the interest was sparked by France when Napoleon I invaded Egypt in 1798, and when, under the reign of Napoleon III, the French were responsible for the construction of the Suez Canal, an idea which had been proposed to Napoleon III. Proposed to Napoleon I when he was out there, based on an ancient, I believe, Ptolemaic Greek plan to construct the Suez Canal. In addition to increasing French influence in what was then the Khedivate of Egypt, following a policy which had been established slightly earlier under Louis-Philippe, in 1860, Napoleon sent an expedition to Ottoman Syria to protect the population of Maronite Christians there from a series of pogroms directed against them by Muslims. In part, the Syrian expedition was a cynical gesture to solidify Napoleon's Catholic constituency after the Pope had been threatened by Napoleon's, you could say, misguided support of Italian unification. However, one of the results of the Crimean War, of which Napoleon III was a principal instigator, was the confirmation of French influence over the Ottoman Empire, in particular regard as defender of the empire's Catholics. Napoleon III thus had every legal and moral justification for the expedition to protect the Maronites. Indeed, as with his Vietnamese adventure, and to a less extent his China policy, the defense of Catholics and Catholic missionaries abroad was a keystone of Napoleonic policy. It should also be noted that this carries on from Napoleon III. Napoleon III begins the serious interest in Syria and Lebanon, and this interest is carried over into the Third Republic. And after the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire, we have the French under the Sykes-Picot Agreement dividing the Middle East between them. The British take Iraq and Palestine, Jordan, and the French take over Lebanon and Syria, which you can say is in part due to the direct historical legacy of Napoleon III. Of all of his adventures, the most famous and his most dramatic failure was the French intervention in Mexico. Prior to 1861, the Monroe Doctrine had served as a deterrent for European powers attempting to exert direct control over nations in the Americas, a policy intended to display American power while aimed primarily at the Spanish, who had lost their American empire in a series of independence struggles, including Mexico. With the beginning of the American Civil War, Napoleon sensed an opportunity to expand French influence and counter U.S. hegemony in the New World. The Mexican government of Benito Juarez had defaulted on its debts to Britain, France, and Spain, and the powers agreed to send a military expedition to Veracruz to compel repayment of the debt. It should also be noted that this wasn't in fact the first French intervention in Mexico, this was the second, but the reason this sticks out is due to what happens next. Once the French were there, the French collaborated with Mexican monarchists and conservatives, mainly Catholics, who were dissatisfied by the liberal and anti-Catholic regime of Juarez that had limited the privileges of the church and forced the sale of church land. The conspiracy to restore the Mexican Empire was long established at that point, but only with the American Civil War did Napoleon grasp at the opportunity. Now, this, coincidentally enough, Mexico was an empire, very briefly, if I'm remembering correctly, in around 1822. The leader of the independence movement in Mexico, I forget his name, unfortunately, declared very briefly himself as emperor. This failed very dramatically, kind of like Yuan Shikai when he decided to make himself emperor of China. And afterwards, Mexico was dominated by a military strongman called Santa Anna. Santa Anna is now gone, and we have the liberal reforming regime of Benito Juarez. But the precedent has been set at one point that Mexico was an empire, and there was at one point a compromise whereby Mexico would have remained part of the Spanish Empire if Mexico had been given autonomy and King Ferdinand of Spain had accepted the title of Emperor of Mexico. Instead, the Emperor of Mexico, again, I apologize for forgetting his name, was consciously imitating himself after Napoleon, being just after the deposition. So it's interesting here that another Napoleon would be responsible for the restoration of the empire in Mexico. The noble chosen to become emperor of Mexico was Maximilian von Habsburg, the younger brother of Franz Josef I, emperor of Austria. On paper, this appeared to be a stroke of genius. France would gain an ally, guarantee French access to Mexican goods, mainly silver, ensure the repayment of its debts, perhaps even precipitate a domino effect where other Latin American nations would follow France. Moreover, the choice of a Habsburg was an olive leaf to the Austrians, who Napoleon was attempting to befriend, while legitimizing the new state with a monarch belonging to the greatest European dynasty. Napoleon even attempted to present this as a free trade mission, and that exporting European styles of government and royalty, in particular the French style, would be conducive to friendly relations with other European powers. The Mexican Empire, however, never exerted total control over the country, as Juarez continued the Republican cause. Maximilian proved to be a disappointment to conservatives when he supported maintaining some of the liberal policies of Juarez. And I've already alluded to the idea that he was also supporting various rights for indigenous periphery people, which irritated the elites in Veracruz and Mexico. Moreover, Maximilian was intent in ruling Mexico for the sake of Mexico, and he was opposed to the idea of unfettered access of Mexican markets to by the French. He did not consider himself a French puppet. So the French ultimately lost enthusiasm. He was not supported by the Americans, and he was not supported by enough of the army and the population of Mexico. The principal factor that killed the Mexican imperial project was the concurrent failure of Napoleon III to recognize the Confederacy in the American Civil War. Napoleon was intent on recognizing the Confederacy, opening up the possibility of European arbitration, even intervention in the Civil War. To do so would guarantee French access to Confederate cotton and ultimately prevent a weakened America supporting Juarez in Mexico or anywhere else the French would seek to claim. With the risk of war with the US over this policy, Napoleon would not follow through with the support of Great Britain, which would present the Americans with a fait accompli. With the British unwilling to support Napoleon's scheme, the Union victory in the Civil War meant the death of the Mexican Empire. With the end of the Civil War, the French evacuated Mexico in 1866. The following year, Maximilian was captured and shot by Juarez loyalists. People have very astutely also mentioned in the chat that the Americans only symbolically had the right to enforce the Monroe Doctrine, that it was also the acquiescence of the British Navy, a navy which allowed the Monroe Doctrine to continue. Of course, the British at this point were the largest stakeholders in the New World in the fact that they controlled Canada, in addition to many islands within the Caribbean Sea. The only power that really competed with Britain, colonial power, was Spain. And of course, the Americans roundly defeated and annihilated the Spanish Empire in the Spanish-Mexican War of 1898. And of course, the Monroe Doctrine thereby favored Britain in that basically guaranteed their own access to Latin American goods. But the British didn't have a principal interest in Mexico. The principal British interest in Latin America was in Argentina, in particular Argentine beef. Perhaps the most pertinent fact to take away from this segment on the adventurer emperor is that Napoleon had developed the infrastructure of the Second Empire to deal with these localized gambits, whether it be Vietnam or whether it be Syria or whether it be Mexico. French expeditionary forces were to be fired from the now formidable French Navy, following a pattern that had been developed by the British Empire, which had far more extensive colonial holdings than that of the French. Consequently, France had a professional but comparatively small army compared to its continental adversaries, namely Prussia. Indeed, a colonial empire required a global garrison force, which after the debacle of Mexico left the metropole, continental France, uniquely vulnerable, a fact Napoleon realized too late, and at that time he was too weak to effectively change what was already inevitable. Now I want to talk about the missed opportunity, and this segment may involve a lot of counterfactual history, because there is so much in this particular time period where Napoleon III, had he had a more far-sighted and consistent foreign policy, could have run rings around the various monarchies of Europe, prevented Italian unification, prevented German unification. He may have even led towards significant territorial acquisitions of France in Europe, not just the reunion of Savoy and Nice. In order to understand the underpinning of Napoleonic foreign policy, after the original Napoleon's defeat in 1814 and later in 1815, France had lost a significant amount of territory. If I show this map I used at the beginning, France at its greatest extent had not only expanded to the left bank of the Rhine, it included a significant portion of Italy, Piedmont, Tuscany, Rome, Croatia. It had also control of Catalonia at one point, Belgium, the Netherlands, and northwest of Germany to deny essentially Germans access to the North Sea and give the French nominally the ability to control and enforce the continental system rather than rely on their vassals. All of this was underpinned by Napoleon's centralizing zeal and ultimately his desire to create a European, not merely a French empire. So that is the precedent that's been set by Napoleon III's uncle. Nevertheless, that was seen as completely beyond the realms of possibility, into the realm of pure conjecture and fantasy, as to be able to recreate that sort of empire without the military genius and the boldness of a second Napoleon. Of course, we aren't talking about Napoleon le Grand, we're talking about Napoleon le Petit. So instead, the irredentist claims of the French at that time, which were around since before Napoleon III, we have Adolphe Thiers and the Rhine crisis of 1840, were to restore this map on the left, France's natural borders, one that expanded to the Pyrenees in the south, the Atlantic and the Channel in the north, to the Rhine, most notably in the north and east, and to the Alps in the southeast. This dream had been realized by, and basically confirmed, by 1802, with the British making peace with Napoleon, with the Peace of Amiens. But of course, Napoleon wasn't satisfied with this significant boundary and instead went on to continue expanding until all of Europe was opposed to him and the coalition forces against France were insurmountable, even for Napoleon and the remnants of the Grande Armée, especially after 1812. So instead, the desire of expanding France, of making France great in Europe, not just great abroad, was based on the restoration of these natural borders in France. Now, to emphasize how significant this is, when we look at the borders of France in 1802 through to 1813, economic considerations weren't as important as they became in the 19th century. Because France lost this territory, it had to accept the loss with the restoration of the monarchy and the Congress of Vienna. France had very little in the way of natural resources to stimulate industrialization. So France actually industrialized after Belgium. Why? Because Belgium had a significant deposit of coal, iron, raw materials that were needed. That is especially the case also for the Saarland and for the left bank of the Rhine. So in losing these territories, which it should be noted, Napoleon I could have easily retained had he decided to have a negotiated peace with Metternich rather than total war or total defeat, this map effectively could have secured France's economic position as well as her military and diplomatic situation into the future as easily the most powerful nation in Europe. However, the loss of these territories represented a serious conundrum for France and indeed for Napoleon III. Even before the Rhine crisis of 1840, Talleyrand, in one of his last great diplomatic machinations, attempted to use the Belgian Revolution in 1830 to carve out a significant portion of French territory. His design was to award France with what is now Wallonia, the French-speaking part of Belgium, give the Flemish-speaking part of Belgium back to the Dutch, and award Britain with their own protectorate on the continent in Antwerp, basically giving them control, a controlling interest over the Channel ports. This situation was rejected by both the French and the British. The French didn't want the British to have a continental presence. The British didn't want the French expanding at all. And so Belgium and the idea of Belgium neutrality became a settled issue among the various powers, albeit you can say a constant source of frustration for the French expansionists, given the fact that there was such a large Francophone population in Belgium and given the material wealth of Belgium. At the ascent of Napoleon as emperor in 1852, Belgium was far more industrialized, far more urbanized, and had far more tract of railway per mile compared to France, which was a substantially larger country. So in every sense, it provided an attractive alternative. There's also another factor. It's not just the Rhineland also, it's also the Ruhr Valley. But with Prussia gaining these territories along the French border, from the British point of view and from the Austrian point of view, this was considered a embarrassment, a defeat for Prussia, because it gave them the responsibility of preventing the French from reacquiring these territories. But in reality, it proved to be the ultimate blessing in disguise, because these regions were the most conducive towards industrialization with their deposits of raw materials in Europe. And indeed, it's in this territory, Cologne, Dortmund, Dusseldorf, the area just across the Rhine in Dusseldorf, that acts as the engine effectively for Prussia's industrialization. And indeed, as the French population remains relatively stagnant throughout the entire 19th century, the Prussian population, and by extension the German population, begins to eclipse France. At 1815, France had a larger population than Germany. By 1914, Germany had a significantly larger population than France. All of this is acting as an existential threat to French primacy in Europe. So that is the fundamental consideration, and you can say ultimately the object, the dream of Napoleon to restore these territories. Someone is asking, how come Belgium was so much more industrialized? It was more industrialized than the Dutch lands. It was already wealthier towards the 18th century. In fact, there was a huge economic disparity between Belgium in the 1820s and the Netherlands. And the fact that the North ruled over the South was a major source of antipathy. Not just that the Southerners were wealthier, but they were also Catholic. So everything contrived to mean that the United Kingdom of basically Luxembourg, Belgium, and the Netherlands would end in catastrophe. But there you are. It was a contrivance of the conference of Vienna. Now, Napoleon is at once derided as being nothing more than a caricature of the original Napoleon. But it should be noted that he was one of the great instigators of the first major European war involving multiple European powers. It's a stream I've already talked about on this channel, so I'm not going to rehash too much of it, but I am, of course, referring to the Crimean War. Now, why is the Crimean War an issue? Well, on the one hand, it helps stabilize relations between Britain and France. But as I mentioned, they were fair weather friends. When it really came down to augmenting Napoleonic policy, Britain was not interested in helping France. And so the idea that Napoleon pinned so much support in on Britain was a major indicator of a lack of understanding regarding Britain's own foreign policy. Perfidious Albion, so to speak, you can't rely on her. And interestingly enough, when we have World War One, Britain did so as a result of madness, effectively, which I mentioned on my previous stream. But here, Napoleon cozies up to Britain and denies Russia controlling influence over the Ottoman Empire. Napoleon also, as I've already mentioned, has grander ambitions of being the protector of the Catholics within the empire, while Tsar Nicholas has designs on being the protector of the Orthodox population within the empire. Napoleon, of course, is referring to an ancient precept set all the way since King Francis I in the 16th century in the original capitulations. And Tsar Nicholas is using the principle which had been established in 1774 when Catherine the Great had defeated the Ottoman Empire. So all of these competing claims, and in particular, the occupation of Romania, served as an official pretext for the French and the British to show their total technological superiority and their logistical capacity over that of Russia, with the siege of Sevastopol and that famous painting of the tricolor over the fortress of Sevastopol. But what does this ultimately do? What did Napoleon ultimately gain? Yes, he gained prestige within the Ottoman Empire. He gained, you can say, more maritime sort of interest in the Mediterranean as a result of this. But he seriously humiliated Russia. And I want to focus on this factor because this again shows a huge amount of short-sightedness regarding ultimately his continental policy, because he has alienated what would later become France's greatest ally between 1894 and 1917. And I posit the idea again, bringing in counterfactuals, of this idea of France and Russia allying much sooner than they did, which would basically serve to prevent German unification, which was so fatal to France as the first nation in Europe. So consider what ultimately was the gain for France in the Crimean War. Napoleon, you can say it's ironic that Napoleon's first war was in Russia, and he won, whereas Napoleon I's greatest defeat was in the 1812 campaign. So you can say there's a bit of historical irony here. But I would say in the grand scheme of things, why would, say, for example, Napoleon have to ally with the British against the Russians? Why couldn't he ally with the Russians against the British, driving out their influence and establishing firm control over Syria and Egypt, which ultimately the British would do? What I'm trying to illustrate here is that I don't see a consistent plan or logic with Napoleon's foreign policy. Very much of it seems self-defeating, convoluted, and this was very much the view of the time of various political factors and foreign parties interested in allying with France. And what I'm trying to get across here is supporting this idea of France becoming increasingly diplomatically isolated. John Locke, real name, I've already mentioned the idea that a consistent trend throughout Napoleonic policy is the defense of Catholics abroad. But I'm arguing, why does that need to be supported by invading Russia effectively? Why not come to an agreement with Russia? Rather than what Napoleon ultimately did was be almost excessively bellicose and support Lord Palmerston and giving Russia a bloody nose. There's also another for Napoleon, the seed of a disaster created here. Who is the other power that joins Russia? It's not just France and Britain. It's also King Victor Amadeus and the North Italian kingdom of Sardinia Piedmont. Sardinia Piedmont had been a Austrian ally until the demise of the older branch of the dynasty and the ascension of King Albert and the creator of the Albertine Constitution. He was the one who effectively orientated Sardinia Piedmont away from Austria towards supporting the revolutionary faction, and he was defeated by 1848, and Napoleon had turned against him in 1848 with the expeditionary force. So in 1858, we have a dramatic about turn. There is an attempt by an Italian nationalist to assassinate Napoleon III because of his previous stance against Italian unification. Again, talking about the contradictions of this man, which were actually illustrated in that tract, that piece from The Ideas of Napoleon that I read to you. The idea that we have a man who was a member of the Masonic Carbonari, who then supports and restores the power of the Pope, and then following an assassination attempt by an Italian nationalist, becomes more responsible than any one figure for Italian unification. But that is ultimately the paradox of Napoleon le Petit, Napoleon III. In 1858, he signs a secret alliance with the Kingdom of Sardinia Piedmont. Now, there are many convoluted reasons as to why he would support this. The idea of Italian unification had been mooted with the resolution of the Crimean War, but it was something that neither the British nor the French would actively support. So why, and again, the British, as with everything, they are sympathetic to the idea of Italian unification, but aren't willing to contrive a means to bring it about, as ultimately was the case with Napoleon. So why would he go from not supporting Italian unification wholeheartedly to creating a European war to bring it about? Well, he was promised Sardinian territory as a result of this, in particular Nice and Savoy, territories which had been gained by France early in the French Revolution, but had been returned to the Kingdom of Sardinia with the Congress of Vienna. So a secret alliance, an aggressive alliance signed with Piedmont, gave France some territory. So we're looking at the map on the left, and we're looking about the restoration of the Napoleonic and the revolutionary French natural borders, but only in a very small way. The only sort of irony that one can take away from here is that Nice was the birthplace of Garibaldi. So the originator of Italian unification would be dispossessed of his homeland and the creation of his new country. So that's something to consider. So we have those factors. But there's also another, even more convoluted factor as to why Napoleon would go from opposing to supporting Italian unification, which is his idea that revolutionary movements across Europe are inevitable. So rather than allow Italian unification to come about and be started by a series of revolutionary movements like the former Carbonari, wouldn't it be much better to help facilitate Italian unification under the King of Sardinia, Piedmont, where there would be some conservative break on Italian radicalism and Italian republicanism? That was the convoluted thinking. But in reality, I can't help but feel that Napoleon III was the dupe of Cavour, the prime minister of Sardinia, Piedmont, because France declares war on Austria together with Sardinia, Piedmont. There is a successful campaign in 1859 led personally by Napoleon III. Now, why would he personally lead the campaign? Of course, he has a background as being a member of the Swiss Army. But up until that point, we're really just talking about uniforms and affectations and appealing to the legacy of Napoleon. And I think this is no different. What did Napoleon I do? He drove the Austrians out of northern Italy twice. So Napoleon III wants effectively to do the same. But again, such is the case with Napoleon III here. This demonstrates the fundamental contradictions and how he is so different from that of his predecessor. The Italian campaign culminates in the large Battle of Solferino. The Austrian side is commanded by Emperor Franz Joseph himself, and Napoleon III commands the French and the Piedmontese armies. The French and the Piedmontese win. The Austrians are forced to the negotiating table. But what do the Austrians do? The Austrians are so incensed by the idea that an upstart nation like Sardinia Piedmont would gain any territory that Franz Joseph compromises. He gives one part of Austrian Italy, Lombardy, not the entire kingdom of Lombardy and Venetia, to France. And then France transfers it to Cavour and the Sardinian Piedmontese. Now, why is this significant? Napoleon III has effectively about-faced and said, I'm only going to help you part of the way with Italian unification. I'm not going to allow you to take all of the Italian territories of the Austrian Empire. I'm going to leave them with a significant footing within Italy by controlling Venice and by extension controlling the littoral and controlling the former parts of the Venetian Republic, basically in toto, and of course controlling what is now the Trentino, what used to be called the South Tyrol. Cavour, of course, is unsatisfied with this, and very much what happens next involving Italian unification is beyond the control of Napoleon III. Napoleon III attempting to limit the expansionism of Sardinia Piedmont. Sardinia Piedmont then goes on to annex Austria's dynastic allies in Lucca, in Tuscany, in Modena, in yes, those are all the ones, the central Italian republics. Then we have Garibaldi's expedition of the 1,000 to Sicily, and the Italian forces from Sardinia and Garibaldi meet in an attempt to annex a large part of the Papal States. So all of a sudden, we have the unification, partial unification of Italy, which had been facilitated by the battles of Magenta and Solferino under Napoleon III. But now it looks as if the Pope himself is going to be dispossessed from Rome. What was one of Napoleon III's first acts as Prince President of France was to save the Pope. Now he's probably more responsible than anyone for putting the Pope in mortal danger. So he sends a contingent of French soldiers to guarantee papal control in Rome, which immediately infuriates the Italians he's just helped support, as with preventing the Italians from going further and annexing more Austrian territory. So all he's really gained out of this war, which has fundamentally changed the European map forever. Italy is no longer a mere geographic expression. It is now a nation. France has gained some paltry territories, and on the back of tens of thousands of French lives, and she has not gained an ally. She has alienated one ally, potential ally in the case of Austria, and she has nearly destroyed the Papal States, which was effectively the bedrock of Napoleon's own social conservative backing. So instead, Napoleon effectively alienates all parties concerned, and this really should be indicative of how contradictory and self-defeating the policy is. So he's alienated the Russians with the Crimean War, and he has now alienated the Austrians with the wars of Italian unification. It should also be noted that after Solferino, I believe, really precipitates a profound change in the nature of government. The humanitarian crisis convinces him effectively to avoid future wars, large-scale wars with other European powers, albeit somewhat localized. And this also precipitates the temporary liberalization of the French Second Empire as well, involving the eventual turn towards a British-style parliamentary monarchy. Now, why is all of this significant? Because now we have to talk about Prussia and we have to talk about German unification. I believe, in fairness to Napoleon III, that very quickly after Italian unification, he understood his mistake and realized that a powerful Prussia was a threat to France, and the most tangible ally for France at that time was Austria. And so, as I've already mentioned, with placing Maximilian, Franz Josef's younger brother, on the throne of Mexico, there are many superficial attempts to try and appeal to the Austrians and again, the Papal States by protecting them into perpetuity. But also Russia needs to be considered as a major power in all of this. And what does Napoleon then do, having humiliated them over the Crimean War? Well, in 1863, there is a major uprising across the entire territories of the former Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, and there is a brutal crackdown by the Russians, and the Russians put down this rebellion, and they begin to impose greater restrictions on the Polish population who live in Western Russia. Now, Napoleon III is in a difficult position. On the one hand, he's looking at the legacy of his uncle, and he's thinking, well, what did my uncle do? My uncle recreated Poland. My uncle had Polish cavalry regiments as a fundamental part of the Grand Armée. My uncle had created the Duchy of Warsaw. My uncle, had he succeeded in Russia, would have probably recreated the French Commonwealth, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, as a French ally. On the other hand, he has to think about the rising power of Prussia and what would be the greatest power to actually defeat Prussia rather soundly. It would be the Russian Empire, an empire which he spoke about with great admiration in his On the Ideas of Napoleon. So rather than appealing to Russia at this tumultuous time, he supports the Poles in their uprising along with the British. This goes terribly. All it does is further inflame relations between the Russians and the French. And I will go out and say, I think I've already mentioned this before, that Napoleon's support of the 1863 Polish uprising is probably the single most important event that would explain German unification in the way that Bismarck construed it effectively. Because with the 1863 uprising, who supports Russia? It's not France, it's Prussia. By Prussia supporting Russia in the persecution and repression of the Polish uprising, Prussia has effectively guaranteed that Russia will remain neutral in any future conflicts involving Prussia and any other major powers. So, inadvertently, Napoleon III has given Prussia its biggest diplomatic ace, one that Bismarck will use consistently for the next 30 years, effectively. And why this policy was so self-defeating and disastrous. And this brings us to, very quickly after, the ascension of Otto von Bismarck. Otto von Bismarck is brought on as a minister to resolve a dispute over conscription. He later dissolves parliament and he effectively manufactures a war with Denmark over the question of Schleswig-Holstein. Now, this is complicated because Schleswig-Holstein was a member of the German Confederation, but it was part of the personal sort of rule of the Danish monarch. It doesn't really matter. The point is, the situation had been a part of international arbitration, and Prussia and Austria and the German Confederation were uniting to prevent the unification of Schleswig and Holstein with Denmark, and rejecting the counter-proposal of the King of Denmark that Denmark simply be admitted into the German Confederation. Rather, they wanted all German territory ceded from Denmark and then partitioned between Austria and Prussia, which ultimately happens, and the Prussians win the war very quickly and decisively. Now here, Bismarck has basically orchestrated that the Austrians and the Prussians are in alliance together, and he fails to make any impression over the Schleswig-Holstein question. He attempts to form some form of grand European mediation, which, among other things, would allow for the possibility of general questions about territory transfers, including possible territories given to France. This doesn't go very well. The British don't support him. The British basically have a non-intervention policy. And as a result, France is left completely impotent and alone. Then Bismarck goes on to contrive over the issue of Schleswig-Holstein and the contested legitimacy over a Schleswig-Holstein which is part of Prussia, or Schleswig-Holstein which is a independent duchy within the German Confederation. It's basically a casus belli which Bismarck had intentionally created, which he could use against Austria later to justify trying to deny Austria its role within the German Confederation. I know this isn't very pertinent for this discussion, but it's all again to explain that Bismarck is the master diplomat, and Napoleon, despite being the inspiration for Bismarck, Napoleon basically gave Bismarck the idea that one can circumvent the German liberals by appealing to the German working classes. And when the Reichstag is created, it is with the intention that there is universal suffrage. So more Reichstags will be created, which have conservative leaning as opposed to a liberal leaning, which the restricted Prussian Landtag had created. So all of this was inspired by Napoleon. And now Bismarck is basically determining the European state of affairs and directing the European powers as if he were in control of their foreign ministries. Someone is mentioning the question about Schleswig-Holstein. I don't want to talk about this too much because I don't want this stream getting involved in something which is only peripheral to this conversation, which is about Napoleon III. Now, this is the time where perhaps Napoleon III had his greatest opportunity to achieve the map you see on the left, which is the acquisition of those territories, which was how he would handle the eventual war between Prussia and Austria, and which side he would go with. He didn't do anything as bold as he did in Italy, which was allying with the Piedmontese and helping bring about a united Italy. Instead, he tried to avoid a conflict based off his experience of Solferino, and he basically promised neutrality to both parties. The Austrians were very excited about this promise of neutrality and believed that essentially if the French would acquiesce to this, they would be given the left bank of the Rhine from Prussia and parts of the Bavarian Palatinate in compensation for them basically tacitly supporting the Austrians. If the French had formally allied with the Austrians, then the Austrians were going to be even more ambitious. The Austrians were thinking about dismembering Prussia. The French would be given the left bank of the Rhine, restoring the natural boundaries. They would be given the industrial heartland of Prussia, while Austria would reclaim Silesia, the ancient province of the old Bohemian crown that had been taken from the Austrians by Frederick the Great in 1840 during the Silesian Wars. And among other things, we would see the creation of a Greater Saxony. Basically, we're seeing the humiliation of Prussia in concert with France and Austria as allies. But Napoleon III made the mistake in not resolutely supporting Austria because it could have provoked a war in which France would have been involved, even though war ultimately proved inevitable. And when France did go to war against Prussia, she was alone against a united Germany and defeated decisively and soundly. In this situation, Bismarck had a conversation with Napoleon III at the conference in Biarritz, and there it was mooted that Bismarck would give France, as a promise of French neutrality in that conflict, the left bank of the Rhine and territories along the Palatinate. It was only mooted. There was no firm agreement made. And really, you can say that Bismarck gained everything he wanted, which was convincing Napoleon to become neutral based on this vague promise of Prussian secession of territory if France remained neutral. And Effectively, Napoleon III was believing he could gain a territory significantly larger than that he had gained in Italy by doing nothing other than sitting back and allowing Austria and Prussia to fight against each other in a long and protracted war. Afterwards, Napoleon III would simply go in, mediate the conflict, and get his choice of any provinces, any territories that he wanted. Instead, Napoleon III was played completely by Bismarck. Bismarck understood that that situation could not happen. Austria needed to be defeated, it needed to be defeated decisively, and it needed to be defeated very quickly. And of course, it was defeated in less than 2 months. Very quickly, we have the culmination of Königgrätz, and in order to prevent the war from expanding, understanding that the French could intervene at any point, Bismarck conducts a very favorable policy towards Austria, in which they would lose no territories whatsoever. Prussia would simply consolidate its control over Germany, exclude Austria from the German Confederation, and establish Prussia its own German Confederation, in alliance with the states in the south. So France has simply seen here the major empowerment expansion of its principal adversary, the humbling of its most plausible ally, and therefore she had gained nothing from this whatsoever. In fact, she had lost a great deal. In fact, the 1866 war is, you can say, one of the most significant turning points in French history, because there's no coming back from this now. France is going to be a second fiddle to Germany forever. Even despite losing 2 world wars, despite German division between the Federal Republic and the People's Republic, ultimately Germany has a greater population and a greater industrial capacity. And France here is isolated and defeated and has alienated its Austrian ally. To make matters worse, the Italians use this opportunity to take away the province of Venetia from the Austrians. So Napoleon's attempts at moderation in 1859 have all resulted in nothing. So Russia is not interested in allying with Napoleon. Austria is only tentatively interested in allying with Napoleon. There was a last attempt by the minister president von Beuys to contrive some form of German alliance, but it never went anywhere. And so what did Napoleon think? Well, Napoleon thought, well, I have made an informal agreement with Bismarck, so I want some compensation for this. And I want Luxembourg. After all this, Napoleon ultimately just wanted Luxembourg, maybe a controlling interest over Belgium. And the only quote-unquote ally that could have possibly supported France in a war with Prussia was Britain, Britain that had no interest in a continental war. And of course, Bismarck simply snubbed Napoleon over the Luxembourg affair. And the compromise effectively that Luxembourg was to remain independent, no longer part of the German Confederation. But France didn't gain it either, nor did it gain any controlling interest in Belgium. So from 1867 until 1870, there was a great sense of impending doom. Napoleon III attempts to change the nature of the French army from what I've explained earlier as this glorified global expeditionary force into a vast conscription army that could potentially defeat the Prussians. This is very much defeated by the generals. And ultimately, France has some 300,000 men deployed in Europe against a Prussian army of 700,000 men, which, when combined with the armies of Bavaria and Baden and Württemberg and Saxony, would very quickly outnumber and eclipse the French war machine. Napoleon is unsuccessful in his attempts to conscript a large army. Indeed, he makes and tries to detract various allies away from Prussia. He tries to form an alliance with Bavaria, but he basically says to King Ludwig II, you can form an alliance, but I demand you give me the Bavarian Palatinate, the territory on the west bank of the Rhine. Of course, the Bavarians are insulted by that offer, and it goes nowhere. So Napoleon III is ultimately isolated, and all it takes of Bismarck is to contrive a way of the French declaring war on Prussia, which would activate all the alliances and allow for German unification. And we have this with the contrived issue over the inheritance of Spain. Bismarck proposes, basically in 1868, you have an uprising in Spain. The Queen Isabella goes into exile, and there is a brief republic proclaimed, and they're fishing for a king. Has to be Catholic, but can come from any of the European dynasties. There is a relative, the cousins of the mainline branch of Hohenzollerns in Prussia, are members of a branch in the south, a Catholic branch of Hohenzollerns called the House of Sigmaringen. One of their number will become king of Romania and convert to Orthodoxy. But the older brother, Leopold, is suggested as the king of Spain. Now, from a diplomatic point of view, as you can see on this map, with Prussia in ascendancy over the North German Confederation, in alliance with the Southern German states, and with a potential allied Spain under Hohenzollern monarch, France was now encircled. It should also be noted that Napoleon III understood this, but because of the political situation, which I've already mentioned, because of the nature of the monarchy changing towards a more parliamentary, press-run state, French national honor is insulted by this, the idea of Prussia encircling France. And so there was a natural momentum on the ground for war with Prussia, a war which Napoleon III does not want but sees as inevitable. And really, he's been carried along with events. He's no longer dictating events as he was in Crimea or he was with Italy. And again, I'm talking about the overall lack of enthusiasm and the failure, the gentle diminishing of the project. And see Napoleon III at his ultimate nadir here, just before the declaration. So on the back of French public opinion, we have the Ems dispatch, basically the King of Prussia, Wilhelm I, is basically ordered by the French, given an ultimatum that he will rescind the Spanish candidacy. The King himself sends back a very considerate letter saying he will consider it. Bismarck intercepts it, countermands it, sends back an ultimatum to the French, and the Ems dispatch again insults French national honor, and it gives all the impetus effectively for the French to declare war on Prussia, which is exactly what Bismarck wants, because now he is seen as the injured party, he's seen as the defender, and France is seen as the aggressor. France had many sort of technical innovations which outclass Germany. So, for example, the Chassepot rifle was much superior to what was the German one, the Prussian one, the Dreser needle rifle gun. However, the Prussians had a significant advantage in logistics, in particular railway logistics, and in fielding artillery. It's interesting really to consider that Prussia was so successful despite having fought no major wars before the Schleswig-Holstein War, and France has all of this military experience, and yet France is so feeble and easily defeated. And of course, Napoleon III understands this as well. Like with Solferino in Italy, he takes up the command as commander-in-chief of French forces. But effectively, him going into battle is him almost understanding that he's lost the war before it's even begun. He notes effectively that he has been dismissed. His wife, Eugenie, the Empress, is effectively in control of France and control of the domestic situation while he goes off. France suffers a series of defeat after defeat after defeat after the culmination of that campaign at the Battle of Sedan, in which Napoleon III is captured in battle and is kept as a prisoner until the final conclusion of peace with France. With the capture of Napoleon III, the assembly in France simply takes power and declares a provisional government. Eugenie herself tries to maintain control of the situation. She tries to contrive at least that maybe their son, Napoleon, the Prince Imperial, will become emperor. If not, you know, just as titular emperor, maybe, just something. And she's part of, Eugenie, part of various conspiracies involving Queen Victoria and the English court to keep a Bonaparte as Emperor of France, either Napoleon III or the would-be Napoleon IV, the Prince Imperial. But of course, the opinions of Queen Victoria don't matter. It is the government of William Gladstone that matters, and Gladstone has no interest in being involved in this issue. the only person who could reliably actually restore Napoleon III, as ironic as this seems, is Bismarck, the man who has so utterly destroyed him in the situation. And what would be the advantages to restoring Napoleon? Well, Napoleon, after a brief period of capture, could be placed in control of a friendly French government, which would basically acquiesce to Prussian demands. But Bismarck is politically aware enough to understand that the French would interpret that, just as it is, as a puppet emperor being placed on the throne. And so rather than doing anything, it would be simply better for the French to create a government of their own and to present terms to Bismarck. As I've already mentioned on a stream revolving around Bismarck, Bismarck was not a conservative in the sort of universal sense. He was a Prussian nationalist. And so he believed if France had a weak and broken provisional government system, a weak republican government, then that would serve Prussian interests. He was not tied to the notion of monarchy to the extent that he was willing to restore a Bonaparte to the throne. After the war concludes, the new provisional government, later become the French Third Republic, blames Napoleon III. He's basically the scapegoat for the debacle. During this time, there is an uprising in Paris, the Paris Commune, and perhaps symbolically, as if to really hammer home the point of Napoleon III's ultimate humiliation, Napoleon III had two residences, one in Paris, the Tuileries Palace, and one outside of Paris, Fontainebleau. Both were the original Emperor Napoleon's residences. Of course, the Tuileries Palace is destroyed during the Paris Commune, and all of the attempts to beautify Paris were essentially held hostage by this proto-communist organization, which had to be destroyed by the Third Republic, by the provisional government. So all of Napoleon's attempts to prevent the situation happening, even going as far as to design Haussmann to design the boulevard system in France so as to allow for accurate crowd control, basically more space, deployment of artillery, a very effective crowd control as opposed to streets where you can easily put up barricades. All of this was for naught with the French, with the Paris Commune. And in the first elections to the Third French Republic, Bonapartist candidates were completely wiped out. Of all the monarchist factions, the Orleanists and the Legitimists, who made a big comeback as they had in 1848 and 1849, the Bonapartists were basically discredited as a major political force. The old prime minister and ultimately rival of Napoleon III, Adolphe Thiers, would become president. And later, Napoleon III's most prominent general, Patrice MacMahon, will become president, in charge of the so-called moral order, the last quote-unquote monarchist president of the Third Republic, a man who thought of himself effectively as a regent for France, leading a provisional government, which would see the restoration of the king. In this case, it would be the would-be Henry V, the Comte de Chambord, the grandson of Charles X. That ultimately didn't happen, which I won't get into in the stream. As for Napoleon III, in 1871, with the conclusion of peace, the reparations, and the occupation of the north of the country, Napoleon is released from his German activity and goes into his final English exile, where he dies 2 years later. He spends the time writing. He visits the spa town of Bath. He visits Queen Victoria, of which he has a very good relationship. Queen Victoria herself suggests the Prince Imperial as a possible solution to the French situation. But of course, all this does is demonstrate how out of her depth Queen Victoria is in terms of understanding the domestic situation in France. But it also, I think, shows the successes of Napoleon III with his policy towards the British, that it is England where he went into exile several times before becoming emperor, and it is to England that he returns, and he is received and welcomed, and you could say even loved by the court in England, as opposed to his uncle, who was despised, and he is sent to a craggy rock in the middle of the South Atlantic. As for the Bonapartist cause in general, in 1879, the would-be Napoleon IV, the Prince Imperial, dies fighting the Zulus at the Battle of Isandlwana. while with the death of the Comte de Chambord in 1883, the royalist cause in France is effectively dead. As with everything concerning the contradictory extremes of the character and actions of Napoleon III, my ultimate opinion of him is complicated. Napoleon III's reign marks the last point at which France could have feasibly become a world power. Indeed, this represents the last time France was Europe's undisputed first nation. You can use Austria, and of course I'm very, very preferential to Austria, but Austria was not a nation, Austria was an empire. And in terms of just the raw sort of capacity of Austria versus France, they were comparable, but in terms of a nation, France was undisputedly the first. Under his reign, Napoleon lost that mantle to Germany. And despite two world wars, that situation has not changed. I might be right, if it might be a Lundi. I always thought it was Isandlwana. The point is, he died in the Zulu War, fighting alongside the British. Thus, Napoleon's reign represented great innovation, especially in the domestic realm. Pivotally, the infrastructure changes, the innovations regarding France's maritime situation, the Haussmann reforms, and yet his reign also represented a fundamental lack of vision that doomed France to a second-rate power. German unification represented an existential crisis for France, one that Napoleon had unwittingly helped along with his patronage of Piedmont against Austria. I'm not going to say that this is an exaggeration, that he was simply Cavour's dupe. For an imperfect analogy, Napoleon was the little Hannibal to Bismarck's Scipio Africans. However, I'm left feeling more sympathy for the little Napoleon than the great Napoleon. The little Napoleon did not invite over a decade of continental warfare. Even the Crimean and Italian wars were to some extent localized. The latter especially had a profound impact on the emperor's character and reign, that demonstrates a humanitarianism absent in his hubristic and vainglorious uncle. It is perhaps because of Solferino that we can understand Napoleon III's timidity and fatalism in the face of Prussia. The original Napoleon was a Jacobin autocrat, a man intent on remaking the world in his own enlightened image, with the Bonapartes as some new postmodern Carolingian dynasty. Though spasmodically, Napoleon III was a conservative defender of the old Europe, while a populist and an empire builder. Nothing illustrates this better than the principal role Napoleon afforded to the Catholic Church in French life. Where the original Napoleon had dissolved the Papal States, as the new Charlemagne dispensing with the donations of Pepin, the little Napoleon was a gladius mundi, the temporal power behind the papacy, before it found itself as a prisoner in the Vatican. And just to illustrate there, with the fall of Napoleon, Italian troops occupy Rome, and Rome becomes the capital of the new Italian Republic, or Italian monarchy. And that is a state of affairs that would endure up until the late 1920s, when Benito Mussolini negotiates the Lateran Treaty with Pope Pius XI. With Napoleon's deposition, we have the Paris Commune. Napoleon's generalissimo, Patrice MacMahon, represented some form of afterlife for monarchism, but he failed to prevent the Jacobin radicalism of the French Republicans, from Léon Gambetta to Émile Combes and other real or spiritual irreconcilables, eliminating the Catholic Church as a power in France, and by extension, monarchism. Napoleon's demise was the triumph of the irreconcilables as much as it was the triumph of Germany. All right, that's the end of tonight's lecture presentation. Thank you, everyone, very much for watching. Because I'm here for about the next half an hour, if you send super chats, I'll try and answer any questions as best I can. Bonsoir AM from DC for £10. Thank you very much. I've missed the last few streams, but I look forward to going through them. Thanks as always for your hard work and perseverance. Well, this is only the second stream. I took a quite a long hiatus since December, but I'm back now, and I hope, touch wood, to do one of these at least once a week, if not once a fortnight. So thank you very much, DC. Unoriginal username for £5. Thank you very much. Missed the last stream. Glad you're back, AM. Thank you very much. I think this is interesting in terms of contrasting, what is it? Contrasting Britain's policy towards France in 1870, which is just let the French and the Germans get it over with, as opposed to their ridiculous policy in 1914. So maybe, if nothing else, contrast, you can say the pure Machiavellianism and the pure self-interest of the British during the reign of Napoleon, as opposed to the self-defeating commitments of Lord Lansdowne and Edward Grey, and the collective suicidal stupidity of the British establishment in 1848, in 1814. As much as I sort of despise Lord Palmerston, in many ways you can't help but admire him. Hitman, for £5, very nice to see you. Thank you very much. Napoleon the First LARPed as Caesar. Napoleon the Third LARPed as Napoleon the First. The first was a tragedy, the second was a farce, to paraphrase Marx. I mean, Napoleon the First was similar to Caesar. The only sort of way in which they were different is that Caesar left Rome stronger than he found it, whereas Napoleon the First left France significantly weaker than he found it. So I guess in that sense, I mean, was Caesar's reign a tragedy? I mean, that's it was a literal tragedy in the sense that he was assassinated. Maybe I'm reading too much directly into your question. But Caesar was a more sort of consequential figure, arguably, than Napoleon, because Caesar set the precedent for Augustus. And of course, Augustus was the man who sort of inaugurated the 200 years of the Pax Romana. We don't have a Pax Francia, do we? Napoleon the First, all he did was invite misery, conflict, and doom. And ultimately, that was the case with Napoleon III, albeit on a reduced scale, fortunately for everyone, including the French, but most notably for Europe. Right. Napoleon III seems more like a Louis the 15th LARPer. I have much more respect for Napoleon III than I do for Louis the 15th. Louis the 15th basically doomed and hollowed out the moral integrity of the French political system and the French monarchy, left it in debt and left it without a colonial empire, and left it therefore at the complete mercy of the English. So in many ways, I would say Louis the 15th was worse. I would say it would only be fitting that Louis the 15th suffered deposition rather than the horrific fate which I've just detailed about Napoleon the Third. The only commiseration, the only sort of consolation I have for Napoleon III is that his demise was more humane than that of the original Napoleon in St. Helena. Conovan, for I'm not sure which currency that is, but it's some dollar. So I take $50. Thank you very much, Conovan. That's very generous. Great stream, AM. This was my favorite stream so far. Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much. That's very much appreciated, Conovan. Thank you very much. It's interesting sort of me talking about this because I almost sound like a French nationalist when I talk about this. But weirdly, Napoleon III is a figure who's seldom ever mentioned at all in the English-speaking world. And it should be obvious from what I've mentioned this evening. I mean, what did I mention in my original sort of introduction? I'll just quickly go over it. A compulsive adventurer and serial bungler, and one of the most consequential personalities in the 19th century. You can't sort of understand the history of Europe in the 19th century without understanding Napoleon III. He is a far more important figure to understand than Charles X or Louis-Philippe, or really the only figure, again, rather sort of appropriately, who is comparable in terms of the impact he had on continental Europe and the wider world, was the original Napoleon. And this sort of gives me an opportunity to sort of engage in sort of my imagination and counterfactuals and wonder how many opportunities Napoleon III had to leave France significantly more powerful than he left it. And how I would deduce that effectively is that he formed an alliance with Russia. And again, he wasn't sort of ideologically opposed to Russia, as I've demonstrated, in the same way that Britain was so ideologically opposed to Russia. He was prepared to accept the Russian situation, the Russian system, as the best possible government, even though it laid at the different extreme to quote-unquote American liberty. So I find that particularly fascinating. But in attempting to realize grandeur for the French monarchy, and in terms of living up to the Polish situation, the precedent that had been set by his uncle, he fell into the same catastrophe and alienated the Russians. It should also be noted that when the French were basically in control of security in the Papal States from 1860 until 1870, the Papal Irregulars, the Papal Zouaves, there were two Polish assassination attempts against Tsar Alexander II while he was visiting the Pope. And the French were basically accused of deliberately permitting the Poles to attempt to assassinate the Tsar. So in every possible respect, Napoleon III had had some bad press. And perhaps there's a tragic irony here that a little anecdote to lead this conversation. Napoleon III was the one who had donated the bomb-proof carriage to Alexander II, the one Alexander II was traveling in when he was going through St. Petersburg on the day he was assassinated. Had he stayed in Napoleon III's gifted carriage to him, he would have survived. But he insisted, after the first bomb attempt had been responsible in injuring people, that he get out of his carriage and he visit the wounded. And that was an opportunity for another bomber to come around from the people's will and blow his legs off. So in some weird way, Napoleon III almost saved the life of Alexander II, despite being accused at that time in the 1860s of having basically allowed Polish assassins to try and kill him. It should also be noted that of all the places Alexander II wanted to go in his retirement, which he would have basically retired in 1882 had he survived, was to travel to Nice, albeit now it was part of the French Republic as opposed to the Second French Empire. All right, that's enough of my rambling. I waited for more super chats, but I think that's enough. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you enjoyed the lecture. Like the video, comment, subscribe, join the Discord, etc. Thank you very much, and goodbye.